Welcome to the Opawa Baptist Podcast. If you'd like to find out more about our church, visit us on any Sunday or online at opawa.org.nz.
I first met Paul in about 2007. At that point, he was the pastor of Kaiapoi Baptist. He was later elected to be our Canterbury Westland Baptist Grand Poobah with the purple hat. And you were the obvious choice, whether you appreciated it or not. He retired 2 years ago, and he's now involved in supporting chaplains, the advisory committee for the military and Baptist chaplains, linking with Rangiora Baptist, and starting a monthly informal church gathering, Ashley Village, in an old church. So just drawing some people from the community and some folk that he knows together. Your sermon was very well received. Normally my sermons are greeted with a deafening silence, but I heard lots of people saying they thought yours was very good. So there you go, take that. And as we've talked about it, it occurred to me that it's not so many years ago that there would have been a significant opinion that would have been that multicultural language was a gift of Satan, not of God. That it was a demonic thing. Having these sorts of conversations now, I think, says something about how far we've come. And it's been good. And I promised the folk here, when I got such a good response to your thing, that I'd get you back, and they're all quite enthused about that. So here you are again. And now you're the topic.
First of all, e hoa mā, ngā mihi nui, ngā mihi aroha, kia koutou katoa te atanei. Friends, good morning and greetings, loving greetings, big greetings to you all. It's great to be here. And my wife's really sorry she can't be here. We babysitting three grandchildren this weekend because our two daughters and their husbands have gone tramping, lucky them, and the babysitter fell through, so guess who's doing the job? So she would have loved to have been here and can't be. So it's nice to be with you again. Thank you for the welcome. Sorry, what was the question?
Mum, Dad.
My parents are an interesting couple. Dad was 40 when I was born, and I'm the oldest of them all. His dad was 80 when he was born, so Dad grew up without a dad. And Mum came from a farming family here in Canterbury. And I can bring out my Opawa link. My mother, when she was a nursing trainee here in Christchurch, came to Opawa for some time, and there was a mission here, and she signed the pledge, and she kept to it her whole life. And I remember her telling me that was here at Opawa. So I do have a bit of a Canterbury link.
And your dad?
Dad came from a farming family down in South Canterbury. But when his dad died, when he was only 7, they were living here in Christchurch, and he grew up with his mum here in the city.
Were they people of faith?
My grandmother and grandfather on my father's side were. On my mother's side, her dad died in the First World War and never came home to meet his daughter. My grandmother remarried, and he was a very rough blacksmith who was amazingly transformed when he met Jesus. And became a wonderful man of faith and a fabulous grandfather to me.
And your father's faith?
My father's faith? Yes, my dad was a very staunch and keen and enthusiastic evangelical Christian, and was also equally keen and enthusiastic and keen to make sure that I went along the same way. And it felt like a straitjacket quite a lot of the time. I knew he loved me, but it was an interesting childhood at times.
So you were a bit of a project for him.
Oh, I was a big project. I was the first one. And because he was 40, he'd seen a lot of people bringing up their kids and reckoned he could do better. And then I came along, and of course he practiced on me. And I've told my brother and two sisters that they owe me a lot. And the really funny thing is, because I broke my parents in, I reckon, they agree with me. How about that?
Now, you went with your family to the Murupara Training School. Now, these folk will probably need telling where that is.
When I was born, my parents were working at a Māori boys' farm school up past Murupara. If you go from Rotorua, going east, you go through Murupara, and then you head up to Lake Waikaremoana, and you come out at Frasertown, then Wairoa on the coast. Well, before you get to Lake Waikaremoana, there's a little weenie settlement called Te Whaiti, and Mangapōhatu, a very important Māori place further up the road. And anyway, there was this farm school there where young men, this is back in the 40s, just after the war in the early 50s, who'd left school at 12, 13, they would come and learn farming skills that they could take back to their home farms and places of residence. And my dad was employed. He ran the school part of it, basic numeracy and literacy and that kind of stuff.
Mostly Māori guys?
All Māori guys.
Right, Māori guys. And there was the Māori Evangelical Fellowship?
That's a later part of my life. When we lived in Auckland as a kid, my dad had been involved with the United Māori Mission, which was particularly in Auckland, and they ran hostels for young men and young Māori women who came from the provinces and were flocking into the city. There were hostels like that here in Christchurch, TK and Rehua, and the United Māori Mission ran these hostels, and a whole bunch of young people became Christians. And they established what was called the Māori Evangelical Fellowships. And there was a church over in Wainoni for a long time and around the country. Unfortunately, they're no longer with us. But I worshipped as part of that for quite a while as a kid.
Okay, and the missions then took your parents to...
Dad was on the board of the United Māori Mission, and he resigned that, applied to be one of their workers, and we got posted up to Kaikohe first of all in North Auckland, and then most of the time was in Kawakawa, and where they worked for the United Māori Mission up there.
Now, what was that like for you as a young guy?
Well, as a young kid, you just sort of go with the flow. This is what's happening, and this is where we're going, and, you know, well, yeah, it's a bit different, but... It's kind of odd telling your friends at school when they ask what your father does, he's a missionary. They're not quite used to that. But it was kind of life, and there were a lot of good things about it, and we spent a lot of time on Marae at Hui and that kind of thing, and made friends with, you know, we were just friends. It was normal, natural, everyday part of life to be part of this very bicultural kind of world.
And you talked to me about having Māori heroes.
Oh, absolutely. Growing up, there were... Particularly, and I'm a bit embarrassed about this, but they seem to be mostly men in my mind, but people like Norman Tarfield, John Pepe, Murray Thompson, and others who were outstanding men, and I just admired them so much. And many of them were very musical. Norman Tarfield used to play the sax, and I loved that. They had a great sense of humour, and they were people that I aspired to be like. And it was great to have those role models of Māori men and women that I really looked up to and respected.
We've headed this conversation in our newsletter, An Atypical Upbringing. It's an unusual one, isn't it? Which is something that you've had to come to terms with later on.
I'm a slow learner sometimes, and it came to me only relatively recently that my childhood and upbringing was very atypical. And from the average Kiwi growing up in the average, mostly white suburb, it's very different. And in actual fact, I'm very appreciative of so many aspects of the background that I was given without really knowing what was going on. And it set me up in a way that's kind of different. And I have a different perspective on a number of things just because of what happened over those years and has continued to happen down through my life as well, not just as a kid with my parents.
Yeah, as we talked, I reflected to Paul that growing up for me, the only contact I had with Māori people was in rugby or a bit as farm workers. And what, I'm 30 years younger than you, so that's quite a shift. Yeah. All right, so what happened then? You came back to Christchurch?
I came down to Christchurch to be a student out at Lincoln and did 4 years out there and enjoyed that very much. I didn't fit particularly well with the Lincoln student, you know, moleskin trousers and a homespun woolen jersey and riding boots and a ski rack on the car and up to Mount Hutt every weekend. And I ended up becoming a voluntary worker at the Open Door, run by the Anglican City Mission in town, where there was a real mix of young people, yeah, young folks, street kids, alkies, and an ethnic mix as well. And I went there one night a week. And that was kind of my escape from this narrow world of Lincoln. I enjoyed Lincoln, but the Open Door experience was really good for me.
Drinking Lincoln, they used to call it, didn't they?
Probably for good reason.
So later on, you worked for the City Mission. Tell us about that.
When I finished my degree, I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do. And Morris Goodall, who was the City Missioner at the time, said to me, how about coming and working for us? And so I did, and I ended up working for the Anglican City Mission for 2 years, running the Open Door Drop-In Centre. And during my Lincoln years after the first year, a friend took me to a little church in the boondocks of Christchurch over in Littleton Street, Spraydon. And he never came back, but I kind of stuck. And I was there through my Lincoln years and also part of the church through my 2 years at the Open Door.
Tell us more about Spraydon in the 70s, it would have been, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yep, I arrived there about a year after Murray did, as it turns out. And for me, it was a really helpful experience because it was a bit of an antidote to the, sorry, Dad, but the more narrow, legalistic, demanding, you've got to look right, behave right kind of world that I had grown up in. And I really appreciated the focus on Scripture and God's grace and His mercy and built some relationships there over time, which helped really save my journey as a follower of Jesus. Because during my Lincoln years, I went through this, you know, I'd go out to my grandparents' farm in Hororata on the weekend and I'd dutifully go off to church. I even taught Sunday school, used to prepare the lesson with the book across the steering wheel while I drove out there. So I wasn't the best Sunday school teacher around, that's what I'm trying to say.
Or driver.
Or driver, yeah, no. And then during the week, I was one of the boys and I realised that one day I was going to have to be one or the other. And I couldn't keep living this double life. And the double life was very unsatisfying. The only person I was trying to fool really was myself. And that took me a long process of working out which way I was going to go. You can probably guess what I chose.
But you talked about Spraydon as being a very formative experience for you, those 10 years odd that you would have been there, something like that?
Something like that, never adding them up. Yes, very formative. As I say, it helped me reshape my faith. And made it much less obeying a set of rules and conforming to certain standards and performance and much more of a walking with God and learning to be a child of God.
And you met quite a significant person.
Yes. One night this young English woman gave her testimony and I thought that's very nice for her, but gosh, she's a bit different. Well, anyway, when I met her, I got to know her and we've been married for over 40 years. So Spraydon, I thank Spraydon for that as well very much.
Now, you ended up working for them as well. Tell us about that.
I was 2 years through my work at the City Mission, and Murray one day asked me what I was going to do, you know, the following year. I have no idea what I told him, but anyway, he said, how about coming and working with me? So that's what I ended up doing. And I was on staff at, and the staff back in those days, this shows how old I am, the staff team was Murray and me. And I was there on staff. Other people came in during that time. For 3 years, and I was working part-time, and on the days I was working at Spraydon, I would knock on Murray's office door at 9 o'clock, and we would chew the fat and pray at the beginning of each day, and then I would do my stuff, he'd do his. And that was an incredible opportunity to be part of the changes that were going on, the learning that was going on, the discovery that was going on in that environment at Spraydon at that time.
Okay, changes, what sort of stuff?
I think it's the same as what we're facing now, a reimagining church. When I first went to Spraydon, you know, they had the numbers of the hymns on the wall and you had the green book and it was very traditional and formal, predictable service. And there were a whole bunch of things that started to loosen up and change, and we were imagining church as something different and a place that people who had no church background could come in and find really meaningful and life-changing. And so that's touched everything, the music, the preaching, the sense of community, the way community functioned, the way decisions were made, the way we reached out to people, the midweek meeting, good Baptist tradition back then of a Bible study led by the pastor on Wednesday nights, that became what we called then home churches. And so there was a revolution going on, and it was very exciting to be a part of.
So sort of for them, the glory days of Spraydon, I suppose, in a way, that era.
Oh, they were certainly exciting days. Mm. They were amazing days. And God was doing something very special. And not just at Spraydon, in lots of places around the country. It was a time when things were fermenting and stuff was happening.
Then you felt called onwards. Tell us about that.
Oh, no, I didn't feel called onwards, but I got asked to go down to Central Otago by the Otago Southland Baptist Association and be a home missioner up in Central Otago in Roxburgh and Alexandra with responsibility for Cromwell and Queenstown as well. So when I needed to escape, I went off and did my thing in Queenstown. And there was a little church, just a little fellowship of people in Roxburgh and a little Winnie fellowship of people. This is, you know, sort of a dozen or so in each place. And I was employed part-time to be the guy to help establish those congregations. So off I went, full of enthusiasm, into the wild, you know, unknown, down to Central Otago, with one little baby and a baby on the way, and we started life in Central.
Okay, so what shape did things take, other than an awful lot of driving?
It was a case of getting to know people and build community and look for opportunities and try to be available to God to do what he wanted to do in those places. And, you know, Central's a place where a lot of fruit pickers come, particularly Roxburgh, and so we were involved with all the folks that came in. I soon worked out that taking my summer holiday over January was the wrong time of year, because that was the busiest time in the town and on the orchards, and we had a number of orcharding families in the church. And we saw numbers of young orchard workers become Christians, get baptised in the pond down the river, and that was great to be part of. Peter Hay, he came later. Yes, I was the first, and then there was another guy, and then Peter came.
Okay, then where to?
Then, rather randomly, we upstaked and went to Orake in Auckland. And I got to know Brian Smith, who was the principal of the Theological College in Auckland. And somewhat surprisingly, since I've never done any theological training at Baptist College or Bible College or anywhere, the principal was part of inviting me to go up to Orake to be the pastor. But it didn't go particularly well, because after I'd been there a few weeks, I went to bed. I got hepatitis B and spent about 3 months in bed and struggled with bad health for 2 or 3 years after that.
So how was it? You'd been on this wild ride, exciting times, and suddenly, boof, you're in bed, you're feeling poorly, and it's a struggle. How was that for you?
It was awful. You know, you've just arrived and you're full of hope and youthful enthusiasm and optimism and all that kind of stuff, and then you're in bed and you can't even roll over without it hurting. And the public health people come to see you and interview you to find who you've been shooting up with and who you've been sleeping with, because it's a notifiable disease. And you start to feel a bit like a leper, you know, that this is not good. And I just felt terrible having arrived at this church and then I'm incapacitated. It was extremely difficult.
And you had quite an experience at a John Wimber meeting.
John Wimber came to town, and I wasn't going to go to that. I was just, I reckon, and my wife agrees with this, that I got depressed. I wasn't diagnosed, but I was really blue. And John Wimber came to town holding big meetings, revival meetings, I'm not going to that. And I'd actually, by this time, after 3 years, decided to resign and move on, because I was just not doing it all well. And I thought, the church needs somebody who can actually get up in the morning and do a day's work, not me. And so I'd resigned. And then I heard that people were going to John Wimber and they were laughing their heads off hysterically. And I thought, well, I could do with that. So I changed my mind. And some of the folks from Spraden and friends had gone up to John Wimber and they were laughing their heads off. So I went along to John Wimber looking forward to a laugh. And John Wimber spoke, and that was great. And then there was this time to pray. And so I thought, yep, I'm going to get people. And they gathered around and they prayed for me. And I just got hit with a flood of tears. I couldn't believe it. I was supposed to be laughing. And I was supposed to be laughing hysterically, uncontrollably, and I was crying hysterically and uncontrollably. But it was the right thing. And it actually broke something in me. It set me free. It was a turning point. Those tears that day came from somewhere deep that I haven't ever cried like that before or since. I've cried all right, but that was something unique in my experience. And I thank God that he knew better than me what I needed that day. And so I said to the church, oh, I'm okay now. And they said, no, you're going. Too late. You know, you've resigned. So I came down here back to my grandparents' old house. They weren't there anymore, out at Hororata, and was on a sickness benefit for a while. And then I worked in a honey house for a while part-time and started a recovery.
And then teachers' college.
Yes. I kind of had it with pastoring at that point. It hadn't gone that well. You know, I was just worn out, and I thought, I'll be a teacher. I've got a degree, and I can teach, and, you know. So, and I had a lovely holiday at Teachers College for a year. And during that time, we were back at Spraden, and there was one of the early initiatives around the bicultural group, and we were part of that. And Leslie and I felt, if we were serious about that, you can't go anywhere, especially then, in Christchurch with this. Let's go somewhere where we can really immerse ourselves biculturally and learn. And a job came up, I noticed, in the Gazette at Ngata Memorial College in Ruatoria. Well, Ruatoria was in the news every second day for all the wrong reasons back then. Fires and murders and Rastafarians, and nobody applied for the job. except for me. And the headmaster very reluctantly appointed me. And so we took our little family, four kids, and I knew most of the North Island, but not that part of it. And I will never forget driving up from Gisborne, an hour and a half north of Gisborne, into the boondocks, wondering what we'd done to ourselves and our kids in a schoolhouse. And the first person I met, it was George Nepier's son, if you're a rugby follower. And he said to me, and I will just tone down the language, he said, "What the heck do you want to come to a dump like this for?" I thought, "Well, that's not much of a welcome." He turned out to be a great neighbour, but we were there a number of years, and they were exciting years.
Now, who here knows anything about Ruatoria or even where we're talking about in the North Island? I remember years ago going for a holiday around the East Coast, and we got to Gisborne, which is, I think, 3 hours north of Napier, so it's quite a drive even to get to Gisborne. And they asked us where we were going. We said, "Oh, we're going to go all the way around the Cape and come out at Whakatane in the Bay of Plenty." And the comment was made to me was, "Well, you better fill up your tank before you go, because while there are service stations up there, if there's a tangi on, forget it, or any other number of reasons." Was that a fair summation of what life is like up there?
Life was, it was different. I remember one... I used to drive this old Datsun 1200, which my sister-in-law one time rolled down the hill, and she came out all right. And I got the car panel-beated, basically, so it was green with brown patches where it had been sort of roughly panel-beated, and I used to drive around in that. But I was very careful about having regos and warrants. No cops ever came to town. There were no traffic cops ever came to Ruatoria. And then one day, a whole bunch of them, a plague of them, turned up, and I got pulled up. Yeah, it was Wild West in some ways, and there were a number of fires and unfortunately some murders, because we got there just after Cyclone Bola in 88. It was a town with a load of lovely people, as we discovered, but also some issues that had historical roots that caused a lot of angst for everybody.
So you're this white guy who shows up to teach at Nata College. How many other white guys or white women on the staff?
The head of science, I was a science teacher. The head of science was a Pākehā fella. And there were one or two other Pākehā teachers and maybe one or two kids. But the head of science left after a term, which wasn't ideal. Made me head of science after one term, which is crazy. And for a couple of years that I was there, I was the only Pākehā in the school, staff or student. I used to call myself the whitey in the woodpile.
So a real cultural and professional depending time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was, although... looking at it from this distance, it probably seems different to what it was in reality. We met some lovely people there, and we've got good friends up there, wonderful friends still there. And we feel very blessed and privileged. And my kids, the same, interestingly, for those years in Ruatoria. They helped shape us as a family, and we contributed where we could, but we were blessed out of our socks in so many ways. It certainly was challenging at times. Yeah, I'm very thankful to God for taking us up there.
Yeah, we're coming to that. Joined a Brethren church.
We got to Ruatoria. Where were we going to go to church? There was a little whare rongopai on the side of the road as you drove in. And I asked one or two people about the churches in town, and there was a Pākehā couple, Lois and Horace Hayden. And Horace had grown up there, had come back to be part of the church. He was a motor mechanic, and he worked for the New Zealand Forest Service. And then as they all changed and, restructuring happened, he ended up running a little business out of his garage at home. And Lois and Horace are two of my heroes, saints who just worked and loved people and cared for people. They did Bible in schools every week for years, and he kind of mowed the lawns and held the ship together at the Whare Rongopai. And so we turned up there and became part of that. And they were in this process of changing from being a very traditional, old-style Brethren church to something much more relaxed and culturally appropriate and spiritually appropriate at that time. And so there seemed to be a good timing what they were going through, our arrival, and doors open for some really, as I look back on it, it was a real privilege to be part of.
Tell us about the home group, because that was obviously significant from what you'd said to me.
There was a Pākehā couple came up the road from Tapuia Springs Hospital. He was a dentist, and his wife was a nurse, and his wife had this amazing ministry among the young women who came to give birth to their babies. And she just loved these women, whoever they were, whatever their story was, she just loved them to bits. And every baby that was born, she would bake a dirty great double-decker sponge cake And before Mum went home with the baby, everybody would have a piece of sponge and a celebration. And a couple of these young mums came from Rotorua. And there was this sort of interest spiritually with them, because Barbara was shared with them about her faith in some kind of way, I don't really know. Horace said to me one day when I was getting my car service, what say we go down to Wetney and Gracie's this week? They're kind of interested. They'd just had a baby. Gracie had had a baby. And we'll talk to them about God. Okay, I'm up for that. So we went and sat in their kitchen and we had a conversation. And before long, Gracie had decided to follow Jesus. Wetney, her partner, had decided the same. And then we had I can't remember what order it went. There was a baptism and a wedding and dedications and stuff. And then their friends, Timmy and Horowai Brown, Horowai had also had children down at Tapuia. And so a little home group started, and over time it grew to 20, 30 people every Tuesday night and in different homes. And the guitars would come out and we'd sing and praise God and we'd share together. I would lead a little Bible study and we'd interact and pray and go home. And they were just magic occasions. And building community and people became Christians, and we, again, you know, we baptised them and we married them. We did whatever seemed, you know, as things happened. And again, I just feel so privileged to have been there. As I say, we built wonderful friendships. There's an Anglican vicar up there now, Panikafia, and she was part of those years, and what a great friend she is for us. She's Auntie Pun to our family.
And you scandalised the local community, didn't you?
Surely not.
No, that's what you told me. It's something about the shearers' quarters.
Oh, yes, we did. It became very difficult after a short time for us living in the schoolhouse in Rotorua, because our kids who were going to local primary school would get this, you know, we're coming to burn your house down kind of stuff, and, you know, kid talk. So it was pretty intimidating, and the schoolhouse wasn't much. And we discovered that there was an old house on a farm a few k's out of Rotorua, which was owned by a couple, and she was the teacher in the little country school in the Makariki Valley. And so we jacked up to rent this house, and we shifted out into the sticks, and our kids went to the Makariki school, which was a one teacher, Afina White was the teacher, lovely Māori woman, a great teacher, and a bunch of kids. And the school really flourished and ended up with two or three teachers, but we were part of that community there, and I went into town. But on the farm, there were a couple of empty houses. Well, we got one, and then there was the shearers' quarters, and we came up with this idea of let's have a Christian community. And so three or four other people came and lived in the shearers' quarters and in the other house, and we were in our house, and we did meals together, and we were part of church together and home group together, and we went off to tangi and so on together at times, and weddings and things. And the local tongues wagged, I can tell you. They thought this was free love and free sex and, you know, craziness, which it certainly wasn't, but yeah. People like to talk about that stuff, don't they?
It sounds like this was an amazing period for you. How was it for Leslie?
Leslie's a girl from Manchester, no Christian background at all. I call her family practicing pagans, and she doesn't disagree, although some of them have become Christians now. It was a huge culture change for Leslie, and it was lonely for her at times, especially when we shifted to this farmhouse up at the end of the road, up a valley. And so there was a lot of sacrifice for her. But the other side of it is that she'd grown up on the other side of the world, and she didn't have some of those misconceptions and prejudices that are common among Pākehā people in New Zealand. Not everyone's got them. But a lot of Pākehā people who grow up in New Zealand, you just can't help but pick up some of the subtle racism that goes on. And actually, I've noticed that people who come from completely outside often come without that, and that's an advantage. Those people don't have to overcome that stuff, and Leslie didn't have to overcome that. And because she's very good musically, she and Pani and others would end up singing at tangi and weddings and so on. And so, yeah, Leslie looks back on those times, she acknowledges the huge cost to her, but also the great blessings that were there at the same time.
After a period of time, you moved on to Gisborne. Why and how was that?
Our two older boys were getting to high school, and I just thought them starting school at Nutter College with me as one of the teachers, that was just not going to work socially, academically, in any kind of way. It just wasn't a goer. And so we arranged with folks in Gisborne, and Pete and then Steve on Monday mornings would jump on a van and go to Gisborne and board down there, go to school and come home on Friday night. And that was a cost to them and to us. And then as Amelia was getting older, we just felt that. And the funny thing about our kids when they went to Gisborne was they didn't fit anywhere. A local Ngāti Pro girl from Ruatoria was in the playground at Lytton High School one day, and she heard a coastie talking, because coasties have got their own lingo. And she looked around to see who the coastie was, you know, the Kazi Bro, and there wasn't one. It was all white kids, and this is odd. And then heard the voice again. Well, it was my son, because he was a bro, you know, he'd picked up the lingo from the kids at school. And he spoke like a coastie, and yet he was Pākehā. But he wasn't part of the Pākehā world, the Pākehā section of society in Gisborne. We didn't fit in that world. But he wasn't Ngāti Pro either. And so that's a difficult place when you don't know where you fit for a kid. And our second son particularly started hanging out with a bunch of kids that weren't exactly positive. And we felt that our time in Ruatoria had come to an end, and we shifted down to Gisborne.
And then you came to Kaiapoi. So this is Canterbury number 4. How long were you there, and how was that?
We were in Gisborne for 3 years. Leslie wanted to do nursing training, and that was impossible up there. My parents were getting older, a bunch of things, and the dynamics for the kids, we felt that we needed to move from Gisborne and come back to Canterbury, which we did. And so I became a relief teacher for the first 3 terms of that year. Yeah, wondered what was going to happen next. And then I got told about Kaiapoi, where they'd had a really rough patch, and would you go and help them out? And so we felt that that was the right opportunity for us. And I was living in Spraydon at the time and started commuting out to Kaiapoi on a 6-month appointment.
Which went for how long?
20 years.
Okay.
They couldn't get rid of me.
And you brought to Kaiapoi all these cultural experiences you've related. How did that get expressed in that church?
I think it's really important to learn how to pronounce things. I used to tell people, I love living in Kaiapoi because everybody pronounces it right. It's a sheer fluke, but they do. And I'm really glad I don't live in Rangiora because they all pronounce it wrong. And so pronunciation's important, and just an understanding of the variety of God's people. And we sang songs in Māori at times. Māori Language Week we always made a real focus of. And the response of people in the church was wonderfully positive.
Okay. Now, you described yourself in your sermon as a recovering racist, which is quite a strong term, and for me, quite surprising given the history of your experiences. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, and unfortunately, it's very true. Because every now and again, I just have thoughts and ideas and things that go through my head, and I just know it's racist. And I think to myself, where the hell did that come from? Why am I thinking that about that person? I'm racially profiling them, whoever they might be. And it horrifies me. So I think I qualify as a recovering racist. I think most of us are, but that doesn't let me off the hook. And I've met racists who aren't just in white skins. You know, racists come in all colours. But for me, it's really helpful to own this tendency I have that comes from somewhere that's not right, that's not honouring to God and God's creation of us. And so I think it's much better to own that than to try and fudge it and say, well, I'm less of a racist than the rest of them or those fellas. That's not helpful.
I'm not a racist, but heard that a few times, eh?
There's a load of people who will tell you, I'm not a racist. Now, they've just done something, I'm not going to quote names, but they're in the news all the time. And the Kiwis, some of them, not just other countries.
Okay. Reflections on the ride. Race and culture. Your father's faith and your faith, your experience of God along the way, what are the things that stand out for you?
It's an exciting journey. And this following God is the most exciting, wonderful journey. And it's a case of learning and unlearning and relearning and discovering and growing. And it's not always easy. And sometimes it's incredibly hard. But it's always worthwhile and it's always meaningful. And it's being part of a much bigger picture that is just such a joy to be part of.
Anything else that's come to the fore as we've talked and as we've spent time as reflections?
I've never had anybody ask me this kind of set of questions before. As I say, I've only recently realised that my background's a bit different, and that's why I sort of don't always fit in some situations, or my thinking is different. My thinking about some things is different, and I'm actually quite thankful for that. I'll tell you a little insight that's come to me much too late in life. I think this whole thing of being a Christian, a follower of Jesus, is about knowing God and being known by God. And that's the the foundation of it all. There's a little story in the Old Testament about a slave girl who was used and abused by her owners, and she ran away. And she's out in the desert, and God finds her, and he says, you know, where'd you come from? Where are you going? Well, silly question's really for God to ask, because if he's God, then he knows the answer, doesn't he? So why'd he ask? Because he wanted to have a conversation with her and interact with her, and he makes a promise to her, and he tells her what to do. And she responds and says, I've seen the God who sees me. And I think that's the essence of it, that God sees us, and he sees right through us. And he loves us, and he cares about us, and he's passionate about wanting good for us. And we can see him. It's not just God knowing us, but God wants us to know him. And I think I look back on my childhood, there was a rather too much focus on knowing about God and not enough of knowing God. And I think that being a Christian is not just about being right and wrong. It's actually more about being loved. And we're all right and we're wrong at times, and, you know, I'm not trying to downplay that, but if we focus on who's right and who's wrong in these different arguments and discussions at the expense of knowing that God loves us and cares for us and wants to work in our lives and the Spirit is there to be a dynamic in us day by day, then, you know, I think that's a huge cost. So for me, knowing and being known by God, which enables me to know and be known with other people. And actually, because I think a lot of us don't really know ourselves, and we're not sure quite who we are and where we're going and what motivates us. And God wants us to know ourselves and to be at peace with ourselves, warts and all. So to know God sets us free to know other people and have open relationships that just make all the difference for us and to know ourselves. There you go.
Didn't want to stop you. As I promised, the opportunity to ask a question.
You mentioned there was a cost to your wife. What about your children? You went to Gisborne because of them, but how did they view all of that lifestyle and your passion for God?
One of our daughters only said to my wife just recently, you fellows were pretty crazy taking four kids off up to Ruatoria where you'd never been before, but we're glad you did. And I think that it's helped build a sense of adventure and courage into them, because they were part of it. I mean, they got dragged along, no choice, but they see that positively.
When these sort of events took place throughout your life where you moved to different places and that, because you'd been asked to or whatever, did you ever sort of feel there was a calling on you to do it, or did it sort of happen first and then you recognised that this was where God was taking you, or...?
That's a hard question to ask, because I think we moved too much. And my oldest son went to 9 schools. I went to 9 schools, and I don't think it did me any favours, and I don't think it did him favours either. So I don't think we got it right all the way through. But we were trying to respond to the leading of God, and in retrospect, I think we got it much more right on some occasions than others. But the grace of God covers those kinds of things, I feel, because no one gets it right all the time. And God isn't limited by the missteps that we make. He can work in the picture.
Have you ever had a time in your life where you have felt called? And if so, how did you recognise that it wasn't you just thinking up stuff in your head and you could recognise that it was from God?
I think I live with a sense of call all the time. And I'm old and retired now, but I think the sense of call I have is just as strong as ever. And I think it's affirmed by their fruit you'll know them as a kind of a biblical principle. And people will tell you that, yes, you're called to this, or they'll tell you that you're not. And if you're married to a wife like mine, then you've got a head start. Because she'll tell me, you know, and that's good if I'm in the right place or the wrong place. But I think we're all called. There's no one that's not called. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're called. Sorry, that's how it is.
Paul, thank you very much for all that.
I just want to finish by saying thank you very much for the opportunity to come. You've been very kind listening to that story. And God bless you on the journey that you're on and that you're called to as a community of God's people. Every journey is unique and special, but the Spirit of God is alive and well. And as we reimagine the future, God be with you, bless you. Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks, Rod.
God bless you, man.